I'm very glad I have a paper in front of me because I couldn't talk otherwise after an introduction like that. A Japanese-American who was interned after the attack on Pearl Harbor writes, "I remember having to stay at the Dirty Horse Stables at Santa Anita. I remember thinking, am I a human being? Why are we being treated like this? A Syrian refugee living in the jungle of Calais, the makeshift camp in France, says to her interviewer, you see how we live here? How can they do this to us? We are human beings. A reporter speaks with a woman protesting the police shooting of Keith Scott in the streets of Charleston, South Carolina. Scott, who is black and had a traumatic brain injury, was killed when he failed to obey police commands. The reporter asks the woman why she is protesting. She shouts out her undisguised anger. We are just the same as you. We are human. The only difference between us is that you are white and I am black. What do we learn from these, from words such as these? Words that are responses to moral outrages. The early Karl Marx provides some illumination when he writes, man is a species being, not only because in practice and in theory, he adopts the species, his own as well as those of other things, as his object, but, and this is only another way of expressing it, also because he treats himself as the actual living species, because he treats himself as a universal and therefore a free being. In each of these situations, we learn of instances where the treatment of human beings makes them feel that their own instantiation as a universal and free being is under threat. They face the possibility of no longer feeling human. Humans cannot feel human without the uncultured ways they understand living as a human, having the means by which to eat, sleep, excrete, congregate, engage productively as human beings. Humans cannot live as free humans when they daily face the existential threat of being gunned down because they are black. Now imagine a philosopher who answers each with much sympathy, since this is not an unsympathetic philosopher. Of course it's true that you are human, but this fact in itself is not a reason for you to make moral claims of any sort, much less moral claims on me. Human is only a biological category, the species Homo sapiens. As it is a natural, not a normative concept, being human has no moral, or at best only weak, moral significance. If it could make demands, the fact that you are human by itself could make demands no different from what any other human, a non-human animal, may make on me. For me to acknowledge your claims, to make any stringent moral demands on me, I need to know your intrinsic properties and those of whom you speak, irrespective of their species. If you all possess morally relevant intrinsic properties, then by virtue of possessing these, you can make claims on me or on any moral agent. At best, such a response would be greeted with bewilderment. Most people, whether or not they're philosophers, understand the implicature of the words, we are human, in these utterances. Namely, that as a human being, I am owed obligations that are stringent, but these are not being fulfilled. Though most people would consider the question odd and puzzling, as philosophers, we are nonetheless supposed to confound the obvious. Still, as Freud said, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. Similarly, perhaps, the assertion that one is human has the moral impact it does, just because the idea of the human is morally thick. While it is hard to imagine any philosopher questioning the implication of the human in the voices I have brought to your attention here, A philosopher once asked me during a Q&A why the humanity of my daughter, meaning now the biological human, gives her a moral claim to better treatment than that of an intelligent animal, he said, such as a pig. The question has arisen in one form or another more than once. This is because my daughter, and here I like to introduce her. This picture you see here is a beautiful woman of 47 with lively brown eyes and a winning smile. She has very significant cognitive disabilities. She has no measurable IQ and can do nothing for herself by herself. She defies the philosophical characterizations of what is human that posit the possession of certain essential attributes as definitive of the human. She is often written out of our moral treatises. Though human, she surely is. If a theory that makes arguments and proclamations about what all humans are doing then proceeds to exclude some humans, it seems fair to ask about the adequacy of that theory. Where people with her disabilities are included, the portrayals are rarely empirically adequate. When the distorted representations of women, sexual minorities, and people of color creep into philosophical texts, not only do they perpetuate harmful stereotypes, they also give a false picture of human life as such. The same holds true for disability. Respectable contemporary philosophers have, for instance, spoken of the radically or severely mentally impaired, although it's often unclear whether they're speaking of actual people or just hypothetical cases. They've spoken of them as unable to recognize familiar people in their lives, as having cognitive abilities comparable to those of a dog, as always remaining at the mental age of an infant. My daughter was classified as profoundly mentally retarded, medical classification no longer used. But she fits none of these descriptions. Nor do they describe the children and adults who live in my daughter's community, nor the children of the many parents of disabled children whom I've come to know. Some medical materials do speak of a mental age, but professional organizations that work with people with cognitive disabilities have urged that this language be dropped, as it is terribly misleading. My daughter, for instance, may not be able to do much more than a very young child, and in some regards, not even do what an infant can do, an infant of 6 months can do, for example, roll over. But her understanding outstrips her manifest physical abilities. For example, she spends weekends with us listening and thrilling to music ranging from Bach to Mahler. And when her favorite Schubert and Beethoven pieces play, she tries to catch my eye so I will hum along. And she has indicated to me, as best as I can tell, through a method of choice that we use, that she prefers to be regarded as a young woman, not a child. Again, let me be clear. My daughter has no measurable IQ. While there are surely those who are still more disabled, she is already in the category of those most disabled. If philosophy is to be true to itself, and help us understand both who we are and what it means to be human beings living in a world with other creatures, then theories that leave out some human lives are unlikely to fully grasp the human condition. As I have lived my life with one so excluded, I have become increasingly convinced that by ignoring her truth, we distort our own. If we mean to understand the voices I invoked at the start of this talk, we need to get clear on what, if anything, is morally important about being human in all its different forms. The received view holds that moral status depends on the possession of morally intrinsic properties. There are many such properties: the capacity for practical reasoning, the ability to form a life's narrative, the capacity to care, and be empathetic, to have a subjective understanding of the self, among others. But these are neither shared universally, nor are they properties that only humans possess. Taking the significance we give to being human on any such intrinsic properties will leave out some beings, some human beings. And looking to intrinsic properties suggests that we consider non-humans with similar properties as worthy of the same regard. While raising the moral status of animals is an important moral challenge of our age, viewing moral status as tied solely to intrinsic properties fails to give us an understanding of why the claim to humanity has the particular moral importance it has for us. Intrinsic properties are not the only sorts of properties we possess. We also possess properties that we have only in virtue of relations that we're in. These are our relational properties. I propose that we turn to these relational properties to understand the moral significance of being human. That significance lies in being able to live our lives among other human beings as equals. Living life as a human being and in the recognition that one is a human being like all other human beings is what moral parity with our fellow human beings demands. The intrinsic properties that human beings possess do not determine whether they possess the same moral status as other human beings. That is the position I hope to defend. In the name of assigning a special moral status for humans, what has come down to us through the ages is the specification of capacities and properties, concepts that are familiar to everyone in this room. Aristotle calls man the political animal. Giovanni Pico della Mirandola tells us, "You are the proud shaper of your being, free to shape, fashion yourself in the form you may prefer." Ben Franklin said man is a tool-making animal. Jonas Huizinga characterizes us as homo ludens. And Noam Chomsky insists that humans are the only animals equipped with a universal grammar that generates a true language. But two canonical figures stand out for their influence and their paradigmatic formulations of the capacities of human beings as moral beings, Locke and Kant. For Locke, what counted as the distinctively moral nature of a human was expressed in his definition of the person, which then became the touchstone for further discussions of personhood. Man, he wrote, is nothing but a participation of the same continued life united to the same organized body. In contrast, a person is a thinking, intelligent being that has reason and reflection and can consider itself as itself, the same thinking thing in different times and place. Locke, in proclaiming the equality of man, meant not the equality of all humans, but of all those who instantiate moral man, or the person. Disability, whether physical or cognitive, was thought to render a human a monster. But for Locke, it was the condition of the idiot, the impairment of the mind, that truly excluded these humans from personhood. Locke places the idiot at the margins of humanity by identifying the idiot with the mythic changeling, a child of the devil, human in form only, who was swapped for the human baby shortly after birth. Idiots thus share the fate of being relegated to the category of the partial human, the subhuman, along with slaves, blacks, natives, Jews, and even women, who all at some time have been refused entree to the class of persons. While the 17th century notion of the changeling sounds quaint to the modern ear, Locke strikes a more modern chord in the following passage. Were there a monkey or any other creature to be found that had the use of reason to such a degree as to be able to understand general signs and to deduce consequences about general ideas, he would no doubt be subject to law, and in that sense be a man, how much soever he differed in shape from others of that name. Locke's turns of phrase were likely just an emphatic way of expressing what he took to be essential for a human to be a moral man or a person. But that sentence might well have been uttered by contemporary philosophers who wish both to open the category of persons to non-human animals if they display appropriate abilities, and simultaneously to deny personhood to some who are born human but unable to display evidence of rational capacity. In that move, they deny the importance of species as a factor in determining moral standing and the moral parity of all human beings. We'll turn to them in a moment. For now, we should note the irony that the philosopher who's the locus classicus of the liberal ideal of equality did not mean that all human beings were equal any more than Jefferson, the slave owner, meant that all men, when he declared, that all men were created equal. For Kant, like Locke, rationality constitutes moral personhood. Kant maintains that only a rational human nature supplies the ability to act benevolently on principle, and adds that nothing else in nature can supply this. This makes man alone in the natural world worthy of a special moral place and a special moral status. This special moral status conferred by dignity belongs to all human beings, even those who, at the time, lack the capacity for rational deliberation. However, a Kantian such as Rawls takes up the question of disability only to set it aside, justifying this move by appeal to ideal theory, which leaves out, quote, the case of disability, whether temporary or permanent, and other costly medical interventions. Accepting that equality is a range concept, which, as Rawls remarks, puts everyone inside a circle within which they are all equals no matter how close or distant from the center, he wondered whether those who were either too medically costly or who cannot exercise the two moral powers can remain in it. And he worried how much of a defect that is in his theory. Some in the Kantian tradition have suggested a form of derivative membership, placing people who are mentally disabled under the trusteeship or guardianship of another. But just as they can be easily added in this manner, so they can be easily removed. It becomes easy to ask, since they fail to have all the relevant intrinsic properties, why society at large should have any investment at all in ensuring them a guardian or trustee. And why should any resources be put forward for their education, development, or protection? Whether we adopt a Lockean social contract theory or a Rawlsian one, chances are that my daughter is locked out, either as a human being or as a citizen. My daughter gives no clear evidence of having the two moral powers or acting benevolently from principle. Even if she does, her inability to communicate such things through language would mean this ability could not be gleaned. The Kantian autonomy of the will may forever be beyond her grasp, yet human she is. You know her humanity in every movement, every look, every response. You know it when you see her thrill to music, giggle at something she finds funny, when she reaches out her arms to embrace you, when she puts her head down shyly, or beams when complimented. She has the feel and touch and smell of a human being. And above all, she is my daughter. Fortunately, we have abandoned the cruel myths of mothers who give birth to disabled children as having consorted with the devil. There is no interspecies reproduction here. There is simply a human child who was born with some impairments, some inabilities, given the norm of the typically functioning human being. Among utilitarians, she fares no better than under the contractualists. A prominent group of philosophers James Rachels, Peter Singers, Jeff McMahon, among others, adopt a position they call moral individualism. They argue against the proposition that being human is morally significant and take the stance that any universal, that is, agent-neutral obligations we have is to individuals with morally relevant properties. It is difficult to find any common morally salient properties that all humans possess. If that's difficult, it's also difficult to find any such properties that humans alone possess or might possess. As we discover more and more about non-human animals, it becomes increasingly clear that we have seriously underestimated the cognitive capacities of many species, in part because we hadn't understood how to assess them. We learn that other psychological capacities we think relevant for moral status, such as being social, having self-awareness, and concern about others, are features that can be found in animal life. Morally consequential properties, such as higher cognitive and psychological characteristics, and the ability to form a narrative structure of one's life, to have a conception of one's own death, and to be able to imagine and attempt to carry out a life's project for oneself, properties that humans have assumed that they alone possess, may also be present in attenuated forms in other species. Those humans who lack these properties are, morally speaking, only marginal cases. In one recounting, these include human embryos and fetuses, newborn infants, anencephalic infants, congenitally severely cognitively impaired human beings who have suffered severe brain damage or dementia, and human beings who have become irreversibly comatose. These marginal cases are used to pose the following question. If we provide special protections to them, then why not include within the protected class of beings members of other species with comparable or higher functioning? That is, those we should not eat, do medical experiments upon unless they benefit those beings, test cosmetic properties upon, kill for the use of their organs, put on exhibition, and in general abuse in ways now viewed only under the rubric of human rights violations. The objection is the use of such so-called human marginals to make the argument for the end of the abuse of animals. The objectionable nature of the argument becomes more apparent in another version of the argument for marginal cases. This one claims not only that human animals with requisite intrinsic properties should have some rights and protections enjoyed by human beings, but also that we should adjust downward the status of these so-called marginal humans to the level of the raised status of those non-human animals possessing such putatively comparable intrinsic properties. So I want to voice five objections to this proposition. First, the terminology of marginal classes. Second, the idea that we should abandon moral parity for all human beings. Third, the idea that one can compare intrinsic properties across species without regard to the species compared. Fourth, the idea that giving preference to our own kind, in this case our species, is inherently pernicious. And lastly, the focus on intrinsic properties to the neglect of relational ones. So first, the terminology. Marginal cases is an unfortunate term when applied to those who have an existence outside the womb, where, unlike the fetus, a person other than the mother can care for them. There is nothing marginally human about people such as my daughter. We know from our history that legitimizing such a category, providing a slot, can be justification enough for those with the power to deprive, neglect, enslave, and even murder those who are only marginal. As moral philosophers, we need to do ethics in a morally responsible fashion. Second, the rejection of moral parity for all human beings. Peter Singer has proposed that we abandon the ideal, and this is his words, abandon the ideal of equal value of all humans, replacing that with a more graduated view in which moral status depends on some aspects of cognitive ability, and that graduated view is applied both to humans and non-humans, end of quote. That we ought to abandon the idea of the equal value of all humans is a moral shocker that Singer sometimes likes to throw out there to shake us out of our moral complacency. But the idea is accepted by many moral individualists. The position of moral parity for human beings is one that I believe we must hold fast to. It is morally perilous to abandon it, especially now when in our own country we see a resurrection of overt and unabashed white supremacy and neo-Nazism. Furthermore, I believe we can hold on to it without either devaluing other animals or adopting a view toward non-animals that is akin to racism. It is true that in Western religion, religious and philosophical traditions, the Scala Naturae situates man lower than the gods, superior to the beasts. But the objection to human special place should be lodged at the claim of superiority and its concomitant right to dominate those lower on the scale, not at moral parity. The claim that humans are not equal threatens to plunge us backwards. The idea that all men were created equal was hard won, and it has taken centuries to make all men include women, racial, ethnic, and sexual minorities, and people with disabilities. To claim that any humans are of unequal value is to let the camel's nose inside the tent. The Nazis' first victims were those with mental disabilities, the idiots and lunatics, as Locke would have characterized them. These were called empty husks, lives not worth living, or not lives not worthy of life. The first to be killed were German children and adults, who were deemed worthy of being euthanized in a program known as T4, after the street address where the plans were launched for Tiergartenstrasse, across from the zoo. The methods developed in this program were used in the mass exterminations of Jews and other despised minorities. The same design of showers, the same gas, and even the same equipment and personnel were shipped to the East and employed to eliminate another group whose lives were thought to be unworthy of life. But surely, you might respond, the program to kill the inhabitants of sanatoria, the mentally ill and the cognitively impaired on the one hand, and on the other, the genocide that followed, were two horrendous but unrelated excesses of the tyrannical regime. However, the words of the perpetrators of both tell us something different. Dr. Menica, one of the physicians engaged in both T4 and the gassing of Jews, another despised groups, was examined by Herr Anthony, the defense attorney of Karl Brandt, a major architect of Project T4. Here's a bit of the dialogue. The attorney, so you had two kinds of cases, the mentally ill, which had to be evaluated according to medical criteria, and those which had to be evaluated according to political and racial criteria. Menica. One simply cannot distinguish the two, Herr Anthony. The two cases were simply not divided and clearly separated one from the other. Peter Singer, when asked at a conference whether he was not concerned about such slippage today, replied that the circumstances that gave rise to the Nazis were unique and unlikely to be reproduced. As the current election has effectively given permission to the demons who previously refrained from the open avowal of anti-Semitism, the dehumanization of Muslims, and the most overt forms of white supremacy, complete with swastikas and images of lynchings, That certainty should certainly be shaken. Only by championing equality for all human beings can we silence the demons. We need to defend the equality of people with cognitive disabilities, however, not only because failing to do so can create dangers for the rest of us, but because people with cognitive disabilities are us in other circumstances. They are the people we love, and for all the reasons that we have a right to exist and flourish, so they have a right to be in the world in all the fullness of their being. Third, the questioning of human equality within the species is coupled with the idea that one can compare intrinsic properties across species without regard to the species compared. It has become quite a matter of course in some philosophical circles to say that the capacities of a severely cognitively disabled human being are comparable to those of a dog. I confess to being perplexed and puzzled by such statements. I'm not sure I understand what they mean. One writer suggests that it is the comparison of what a dog and what a human can do on their own. If this is what it meant, then I fall short of what a dog can do on its own. The dog can hunt for food, survive outdoors, does not need to dress itself, not to mention that a dog's sense of smell and hearing are so much more acute than my own. But one can object, these are not more relevant capacities. My response is, surely they are. That I cannot procure food on my own means I need social networks the dog doesn't need. The same applies to the ways dogs survive on their own, in ways that are impossible for me. And the fact that a dog has over 220 million olfactory receptors compared to my mere 5 million means that my perception of the world is significantly different and warrants different treatment for both me and the dog. Both dogs and humans desire affection, but if my dog... But if my dog, whom I've named Spinoza because of the curious physical resemblance of the canine and the philosopher, and Spinoza, my favorite philosopher, is denied his rich olfactory environment, I have mostly treated him with less moral consideration than if I had deprived him of some petting. That my daughter is even less self-sufficient than me hardly makes her capabilities comparable to a dog's. It's true that a dog can't manage an IQ test, and neither can my daughter. But most likely this is for different reasons. A human IQ test for a dog would be ludicrous. In the case of my daughter, we don't know exactly which of her disabilities prevents her from performing on one. It's true that my daughter is without human speech, and so is my dog. Both do manage to get many of their needs and desires communicated to me, but my daughter is many times better at this than my dog, in part because as a fellow human, I can more easily understand what she wants, since a dog has wants I can scarcely imagine. What does one want if one has a sense of smell 40 times as powerful as our own? More important still, the ability to do things is not a necessary expression of what one understands. So it's not clear to me what is being compared. The fact of the matter is that each species has developed unique ways of cognizing the world, and these have developed in tandem with the sorts of things that matter to that species. As Franz de Waal has said, every species is uniquely adapted to its own ecology. If that is the case, then we can make at best only analogical comparisons, not direct comparisons across species. There is not one scale of intelligence any more than there is one Scala Naturae. At the same time, Fong also reminds us no trait, not even our beloved linguistic ability, ever comes about de novo. Every new trait taps into existing structures and processes. Thus, we have good moral reasons to attend to such continuities. So fourth, we still need to worry that when we prefer our own species, we practice speciesism, which is pernicious and morally arbitrary. If, as seems to be the case, we need a good reason to prefer one individual rather than the other, then giving preference to an individual because she belongs to my own species simply seems not good moral reason, not to be a good moral reason for this preference. This is like nepotism rather than fair competition in hirings. However, in the ordinary course of things, the favor we extend to members of our own family is compatible with neither harming nor dominating those of another family, and gives us no license to do either. Indeed, racism and other noxious isms is not merely preference for one's own kind. We can make a distinction between a primal group, by which I mean a group based only on relational properties as criteria for membership, on the one hand, and a constituted group, that is a group based on members all possessing certain qualifying traits, on the other. A family, for example, is a primal group. One's membership in a family doesn't hinge on one possessing a fashionable hair color or an IQ over 130. One belongs to a family only by virtue of having been born, married, or adopted into the family. Race is only mistakenly identified with primal groups. Scientists have made clear that, biologically speaking, there is no such thing as race, just clusters of features that tend to be inherited together. Those features are superficial, and a study of DNA reveals that a black and a white person are as likely to have as much DNA in common as two white people, and just as likely to differ in genetic material from each other as two members of the same race. Furthermore, conventions often determine race. A light-skinned person with an African ancestor was classified as white and given the privileges associated with whiteness in French-owned New Orleans. Once the U.S. purchased Louisiana, the same person became black, according to American law that stipulated that one drop of Negro blood was sufficient for the person to be considered a Negro. Examples of such arbitrariness abound. What is steadfast is that a subordinated race is characterized by the dominant race as possessing those traits regarded as undesirable, while members of the dominant race view themselves as those who possess desirable traits. Now I submit that racism is less about preference for one's own race than we presume. Instead, it is largely about dominant groups' appropriation of traits they deem desirable, and the attribution of undesirable traits to the subordinate groups. We see that racists will expel individuals from their own primal group if those individuals manifest undesirable traits. The Nazis' first venture in creating the Übermensch were to rid themselves of fellow Germans who exhibited or carried undesirable attributes. T4, remember, originally executed only German children and adults, not Jewish ones, who were thought unworthy of the kind mercies of euthanasia. Early on, and in rapid succession, the regime implemented the sterilization of inferiors laws, the law for the prevention of progeny of hereditary diseases. These were aimed at Germans with the end of ridding the future populations of feeble-mindedness, epilepsy, and schizophrenia. Miscegenation laws are vital to this form of racism. In Germany, it came in the form of Nuremberg laws passed 2 years after Hitler's rise. In our own country, miscegenation laws remained in place after Brown versus Board of Education after the Civil Rights Act and after other laws aimed at ending legal discrimination. Why was miscegenation such a late holdout? Miscegenation threatens to break down the barriers holding the prized attributes in and keeping the devalued ones out of the constituted groups. As long as racial purity is guaranteed, members of the constituted group are in sole possession of the intrinsic properties definitive of their privilege. When we define a category such as personhood, we create a constituted group based on the possession of cognitive capacities which are thought to be morally superior traits. The argument above suggests that such a category may be less compatible with a healthy respect for those without these cognitive capacities, be they human or not. Groups based solely on relational properties, on the other hand, can be compatible with both a preference for one's own kind and with respect for other kinds, since the definition of who belongs is not tied to their own possession of superior traits. What I hope to have established by now is that we should stop talking about marginal humans, that moral parity among all humans is a moral requirement for a decent world, that intrinsic properties are properties that are species-specific even when they are similar across species, and that preference for one's own kind by itself need not be pernicious. My final task now is to offer an alternate conception. The view that moral status depends on intrinsic rather than relational properties has long been the received view, not only among moral individualists with a utilitarian bent, but by Kantians and contractarians of various sorts. The difficulty for those who hold this view and who want to say that being human is morally significant is that one cannot specify morally relevant intrinsic properties possessed by all and only humans. It seems like the only definition of the human that will stand up to scrutiny is one that seems woefully inadequate to serve as the basis for a morally thick concept. The only property, that is, without question, distinctive of human beings and common to every human being is being of woman born, that is, being the offspring of a human mother and a human father. This deflationary definition directs us to no morally intrinsic properties that justify any moral treatment, much less moral preference, benign or injurious. Not only is it a biological definition, it is a relational definition. The relational property of being human, however, binds all humans as all humans stand in this relation. But this relationality is prior, morally and conceptually, to any intrinsic properties. We have a moral obligation to other human beings for the simple reason that we find ourselves in relation to them. We cannot be the sorts of creatures we are except by being in relationship to other human beings. Let me inject a terminological note. I speak of relation when I mean an association that is marked with fairly specific social, legal, political, and moral demands. I speak of relationships when the roles in the relation are occupied by specific individuals. How are relations normative? Let us start by considering the parent-child relation. The fact that my daughter is my daughter creates a set of moral obligations to her that others do not have and that I cannot forego without well-warranted reproach. These obligations are temporally and ontologically prior to my knowing anything about her, other than that she is dependent on me, where dependency is again a relational property. That dependency on me means that it is my responsibility to assure her welfare as best as I am able. Even external constraints may not limit my obligation if it is possible for me to fight against such obstacles in order to care for my child. Being in relation obliges me. I start with this relation not only because it is the most familiar, but also because it's the most universal. That is, when mother is understood as any person, male or female, who takes on the responsibility for caring for a child. Aside from species membership, if there's any property that all humans who survive birth have in common, it is that they are some mother's child, mother understood in this larger sense. That is, each of us, if we are to survive, much less thrive, must be in a relationship of care to one or more mothering persons. One passage I cited earlier from Locke is an example of how philosophers, while acknowledging our corporeality, regard the casing of those of our cognitive capacities as rather inconsequential. We care for by a mother, however, with a specifically human body. It's inevitable that when we incorporate a human form into any sense of self that we develop. Now, all relations are not as demanding as parenthood. The obligations of friendship dissolve when the relationship ends. Aristotle in books 8 and 9, in Ethics, details different sorts of friendships with their various expectations and demands. Contractual relations are more structured than friendship, with explicit entry and exit options, and public laws and conventions. Obligations hold for all who occupy the relational roles, but they bind only those who occupy them. That is, they remain agent relative. I, as a parent, have a strong obligation to my child. I, as a friend, commit myself to certain obligations while we remain friends. I, as a citizen, have obligations to my fellow citizens. However, notice that there are constraints with respect to who can enter these relations. Only another human being can be your child or your fellow citizen, though it seems false that only humans can be your friends. As Stephen Kosice-Stowe, a disability scholar who was blind, said upon the death of his beloved dog, "When your service dog dies, there simply aren't enough antidepressants." However, relationships with grizzly bears, lions, and even human-raised adoptions are advised. The relation we have to any human being, not any particular human being, however, is not simply the outermost ring of the set of relations that are possible with other human beings. Were that the case, then the obligations we have would get weaker as the rings become larger. Instead, the relations which we have to all other human beings begins with the relationship we have to ourselves. As much as we experience ourselves as singular entities, an important insight developed by feminist philosophers is that this self is both effectively and constitutively relational. It is a self nourished, defined, and constructed in relationship with others. Both the particular body in which I am born and the relationships that shape me, however, are contingent. They could have been otherwise. The scope of those conditions that could have been otherwise are possibilities of any other and only another human being. We can represent this universe of possibilities as the set of all mere possible worlds in which my situation is different than it is, perhaps only slightly, perhaps very different. The actual I stands in a modal relation with all the I's in all the mere possible worlds to the actual world. The reversibility of perspectives that gives us the golden rule and the categorical imperative are based on such possible imaginings. There need be no causal line that would connect my current fate to another for me to stand in this modal relation to another. That I am, the I that I am now, could have been born with a congenital disability that would have made me incapable of being taught to read or write. Yet I can imagine some near possible world in which that would have been me. There's even some near possible world where I might have been an anencephalic infant who failed to survive beyond a few months. And perhaps there's a possible world in which I could have been a swimmer as accomplished as Michael Phelps. That's probably a very distant possible world. Yet, with apologies to Kafka, there's no possible world, certainly no near possible world, in which I could have been born a log bug, or a dog, or even as close an evolutionary cousin as a chimp. When we do engage with our modal selves, what we gain is something I want to call moral access. And that is an opening, a conduit to having moral regard for another. Moral access is a concept that I think we are missing when we try to assess the moral status and the moral demands of the other. So let me explain what I mean by moral access. It is access to something that is morally significant in the world. There are times when such significance is entirely transparent to us, when our moral principles guide us in a reliable fashion, when our empathy is already active and we understand how to respond. But in situations where another's plight, struggle, or needs go unnoticed, when we are indifferent or unaware of the impact of our actions on those whom we don't recognize as moral equals, we need something, a narrative, a tap on the shoulder, to shake us out of our indifference and to gain something that is more than epistemic access to the other. This is the access to what the other cares about, and her entitlement or right to have these cares taken into account. Thus, moral access is important if we are to care about another's suffering and understand the moral claim another has on us. The refugee in Calais, waiting to make a stowaway journey to the United Kingdom, was asking us to access her sense of distress, to share her indignation, and to have us share the pain of losing moral significance in the eyes of the world. How could they treat us this way? We are human beings. As a human being, I can place myself in what for me is a possible world, but for her is her actual world. And so I gain a measure of moral access to that world. The common humanity that the Black protester invoked was to give the interlocutor access to the moral drama as she saw it, and in so doing, she hoped to evoke the needed response. When I introduced my daughter and told you that she is the sort of individual who is written out of much moral theory, I was looking for a way to give you not just epistemic access to who she is, important as that is, but moral access, access to her moral worth. I bring forth for your consideration an actual someone who happens to be my daughter. I am a philosopher, like you, standing here speaking with you. You might be a daughter or a child. You have some understanding of how vital it is for you that your child should be respected as a moral equal. I am inviting you to consider if your son or daughter were like my own, would you consider her as morally the equal of a pig, much as you might like and respect a pig? I am asking that we do the work of moral access, to look at another human being as a possible I, whom we could take an interest in, express a concern for, knowing that by virtue of this relation, the other exerts a moral authority over us. Now, you might say, don't we also need moral access into the plight of animals who are made to suffer on account of human desires? I've argued that in the case of humans, we stand in morally significant relations prior to knowing anything about their morally salient traits. Yet the knowledge of how we ought to fulfill these obligations is dependent on their actual moral salient capacities or potentials. Although we can have important relationships with animals, the main route to our moral obligations to animals is not through relations, but through knowledge of their intrinsic traits. Being human is a sufficient condition for the stringent moral obligations we have to humans, but it needn't be a necessary condition. As we learn about the lives of animals, we recognize features that we respond to in human beings: their sociality, their cleverness, their reaction to pain, and their need for an environment in which to live out their species being. We learned that the orphaned elephant, juvenile elephants, rampage villages and kill humans, either because they were improperly socialized or because they are revenging the killing of their mothers. We see the mother of Mim Chimpsky trying to hide her infant from the researchers who will snatch him away. I watch my dog join in the celebration of my birthday by bringing me his favorite toy as others sing happy birthday. In all these cases, we can deduce from the animal's behavior what they care about in ways that are discernible to us. These animal behaviors are evidence of morally important intrinsic properties that give us reason to respond to them in species-appropriate ways, just as intrinsic properties inform us how to fulfill obligations to humans. The moral access we gain to non-human animals comes primarily through the behaviors we recognize from our own interactions with other human beings. It will be more difficult and sometimes impossible to recognize morally relevant properties of beings as different from us as the octopus. The epistemic limitations imposed by our different bodies and our different ways of life impose limits to our moral access to non-humans. With animals other than humans, we cannot project an I into another possible universe where I am that being. But I can see myself in a Japanese internment camp in the jungle of Calais as the mother of a young black son lost to police brutality, or the child of a police officer killed while on patrol. And I can see myself in the disabled person who, like my daughter, needs someone to speak for her. Each is a facet of myself refracted in the prism of possibility. It is the real as well as the possible relations to other human beings, not any set of intrinsic properties belonging exclusively to humans, that ensure that being human will always remain morally significant.